Today on the 21st show, it's been 2 weeks since Donald Trump was sworn into his second term as president. Since then, he's moved to fire an unknown number of people, from prosecutors to admirals. He's worked to bend state government and local government to his will. He's imposed a communications blackout on medical research. And his associate, Elon Musk, who holds no official government position, has installed his people in key agencies overseeing government personnel, payments, and computer systems. We're going to take stock of where we are with Nicholas Grossman and Malaika McKee, both of the University of Illinois. We also want to hear from you at 800-222-9455. What do you think of the job Trump has done so far? What are you most worried or excited about? And how have congressional Democrats and Republicans done in response? 800-222-9455. I'm Brian Mackey, and that's all coming up today on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media. But first, the news. From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. As we go to air Monday morning, it's been 2 weeks since President Donald Trump was inaugurated. Since then, he and his people have carried out a dizzying succession of actions, aimed at quickly and in some cases possibly illegally bringing the government into alignment with their vision of America. An incomplete list of what's happened includes firing the heads and other top career officials at numerous government agencies, firing inspectors general, seeking the names of potentially thousands of FBI agents and support personnel who worked on Trump investigations, Elon Musk seizing control of government computer systems, including those responsible for personnel and payments, literally erasing the mere mention of trans people from government websites, and suggesting a quote-unquote clean out of Gaza with Palestinians going to Egypt and Jordan. I could go on and on, but we've only got an hour, so I'll just wrap by quoting a headline from The Bulwark this morning, which called this a crisis, quote, more dangerous than Watergate. We heard from some of you in our texting group. Dolan and Ethan said, I want to believe he's making America better, but right now it feels like he's a brat child burning ants with a magnifying glass. Time will tell. And Vicky in Centralia said, I think it is terrifying to watch the dismantling of democracy. Trump's goal is absolute power to enrich himself. He cares not about the American people. People who think he works for them are naive and ill-informed. You can join us throughout the hour today at 800-222-9455. What do you think of the job Trump has been doing? What most concerns you or maybe excites you about the Trump agenda? And how have congressional Democrats and Republicans done in response? 800-222-9455 is the number. That's 800-222-9455. Joining me to help make sense of this are going to be two people from the University of Illinois. We're going to start with Malaika McKee, an assistant professor in education policy, organization, and leadership. She was also previously director of training at the Western Regional Director of the National Civilian Community Corps, which is part of AmeriCorps. Malaika, welcome to the 21st Show. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm so glad that we're hosting this very important conversation about democracy and asking people to do the work of citizenship, which is to chime in, yeah. Say something.
More than every 4 years or every 2 years, most
right.
Definitely.
That's
so
right.
So let's just start with a temperature check. Where are you 2 weeks in? It feels like 2 months or maybe 2 years.
It's been a whirlwind. I'm just going to share some very personal stories from a professional perspective. We received a flurry of emails as professors from an administrative perspective where folks were wondering, what does this all mean for us who have grants, who have research projects, who have international students who are attached to doctoral studies, for our students who receive Pell Grants and federal aid? All of these questions really became quite apparent. Because for most of us, the workings of the federal government seem like they're in the background. We have these systems that we rely on that just kind of work seamlessly, right? The checks come, the federal financial aid is cut, students get their monies allocated on time, and suddenly it was all screech, all stop. And I don't think any of us professionally, you know, you hear these things could come, but are you really ready? And it put those questions immediately into fore around how universities do our work.
Yeah, and I definitely want to get back into that a little later in the conversation, that funding question in particular, because it is so important at universities. But beyond that, Meals on Wheels, so many.
Yes.
I think people were coming alive to the idea of exactly how many things government does that they don't think of. The political scientist Suzanne Mettler had this book some years ago called The Submerged State, which basically posits that people just have no idea what government does by and large, beyond, you know, the Army and Medicare, and maybe not even that. Let me bring another voice into the conversation. We have also with us for the hour today, Nicholas Grossman, who's a political science assistant professor at the U of I. He's also the senior editor of the news site Arc Digital, the author of the book Drones and Terror, Asymmetric Warfare and the Threat to Global Security. Nick, I know you rushed here to be with us from class today. Thanks for being here.
Sure, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So let's start. Same question to you as I did with Malaika to start. Temperature check. Where are you 2 weeks into the Trump administration?
Oh, I think it's going. It's very chaotic. And I don't want to say worse than I thought, because I thought that it was going to be pretty bad, but I didn't necessarily anticipate all of the details, especially the rapid movement to pick fights with U.S. allies.
And all right, so I'm not even sure where to start. There's so much we can talk about today. So this is something I want to get into as we go along, because some of these things are, you know, legitimate things that an administration can do if it wants to reverse the policies of the previous administration. And then some of the things are, you know, perhaps unconstitutional or illegal. And we can talk about how we think about those differences. And I don't know, maybe we should start with one of the pieces of news that just came out over the weekend, which is the Trump administration firing more than a dozen prosecutors at the Justice Department for having worked on investigations related to Donald Trump, including his refusal to return classified documents after leaving office and his role in fomenting the riot at the Capitol building. The administration is also looking at hundreds or maybe even thousands of FBI agents and support personnel who worked on those investigations. Nick Grossman, what do you make of these developments?
So both of those look to me like a attempt to corrupt American law enforcement and make it, instead of a impartial law enforcement agency that tries to, in the classic Justice Department phrase, to apply the law without fear or favor, to enforce law without fear or favor, and turn it into one that is loyal to the president's personal interests, not to the Constitution or the country, and trying to advance those. So this is a good example of something where of questionable legality. I think there's probably a pretty good case lawyers can make that it is legal for the president to remove, for example, you know, people from the Justice Department or from the FBI. After all, the Constitution doesn't say that there is, you know, an FBI or a Justice Department. It says there's a president and people elect the president. The president is the one with that authority. But it is clearly against norms, against internal policies, against the way that these have operated for decades, which is that the FBI agents, the DOJ prosecutors that are being fired, that have been removed by the Trump administration, are being removed because they did their job and followed the law. That is the thing that the White House has been objecting to and is removing them for. And when you combine that with the pardons for the January 6th attackers, you know, including a number of people who assaulted police or got convicted by juries of seditious conspiracy and other very serious charges, that is also technically legal in the sense that the pardon power is largely unlimited under the Constitution, but also wildly against norms. And the sort of thing that is a flagrant abuse of power would have been considered that previously. But since it is Congress's job to call things abuses of power, and the one recourse to that is impeachment, and Congress is choosing not to, that makes it de facto legal, or at least de facto, it's going forward and going to happen anyway. But it does represent a change in law enforcement and the approach of the federal government to law enforcement to something that modern Americans have never seen before.
Modern Americans have never seen before. Malaika, where are you on that? And I guess this, I want to come back. I'm glad Nick mentioned the pardoning of the, you know, what, I lose the exact number, but well more than 1,000 people who were convicted of crimes related to January 6th, which was on day one. Hard to remember. That was 2 weeks ago now.
Mm-hmm. I think it would be important for our listeners to understand that many of these changes are informed by big ideas. The big idea at the Supreme Court level is this idea of unitary executive theory. And what this basically promulgates is the idea that the executive branch is whatever the president says it is. Whatever oversight that the president decides is important, regardless of the decisions of the judiciary or Congress, that this idea of a unitary executive theory is so important for thinking about how we distribute power amongst what we say is a balance of powers. The unitary executive theory changes it more to the executive office. So there have been several legal cases that have, of course, supported that theoretical position. One of them is specifically Trump versus United States, where the courts ruled that the president has absolute immunity from criminal prosecution for actions within the core of their constitutional powers. It's a presumptive immunity, if you will. This is also coupled with the decisions from Chevron, basically saying that the ideas that the federal agencies can provide oversight for, you know, things like clean water, clean air, that these are now more decisions that are going to judges. So I think when we step back from this and say, did this thing just happen all of a sudden? No, it was this creeping incrementalism that was happening at the judiciary level, coupled with political behavior that brings us to this point. Of course, it is a set of information that for most citizens are not reading SCOTUS decisions. Most citizens are on their television or on social media getting the 22nd bite. And so this is, I think, a set of decisions that really force us as citizens to do reading, to really become extremely informed. But of course, all of this is in the concept of shock and awe. It seems like things are just popping up left and right. You know, it's almost relentless. And from a political perspective, given that shock and awe comes from the history of the military, that can be effective to a point, right? For those who want to organize and get things together to try to resist what these things mean from a policy perspective, it's very difficult to react when every other hour, slight exaggeration, but you get my drift. It feels like that.
Not much.
That something else is happening and we're all just kind of scrambling, like, you know, shining a light in the dark and all of the spiders move to the corner or something. But it's just it's intentional. But I want to let the listeners know that this has been planned. This is not something that just happened overnight or even happened after our elections in November. This has been years of planning and in the making. And because of that, it feels very thorough. It feels that it is at all levels of governance, and it makes it very difficult.
Nick Grossman, talk about that. How are you? You are a very, I think, don't take this the wrong way, but you are a very online person. You're very active on social media. How are you keeping up and keeping your eye on what's important and what's, you know, something to let go of?
Oh, so I don't take that the wrong way. I mean, that's true. I do. And spend a bunch of time online. And figure out which one? It's hard that both if you're experiencing this through social media, there's an element of context collapse in which you are scrolling through and a post about the Office of Personnel Management having a number of Elon Musk operatives, these six young men that this just happened over the weekend, going and downloading a bunch of personnel data, that ends up being put in almost the same level of importance as, I don't know, celebrity gossip or some sports result or what have you. So it ends up being hard to figure out what exactly is most important. And with the shock and awe that you mentioned previously, that part of the intention with doing so many things at once is to make it that it is disruptive and it's unsettling and people can't find a way to really focus on any one of them. It's hard, even on this show, you can hear as we're talking about it, that there are so many of these things to bring up that it is hard to spend that much time on one. So whereas I agree that things have been, this didn't come out of nowhere. That there have been things like a movement to get the unitary executive theory, or at least when Republican Republican presidents to say that, you know, they have more executive power, that a lot of the advocates of it tend to walk back from it when it's a Democratic president. But either way, that, you know, where they make that argument. And there have been things. Project 2025 is a good example of one of the reason why this is going so fast is because think tanks, especially the Heritage Foundation, drew up a lot of these executive orders in advance and worked out on a lot of these plans. At the same time, something like let's just let a bunch of people who were convicted by juries of assaulting police out of jail because they were committing those crimes on behalf of the president and trying to overthrow the election to install him in power, that is something that we've never seen before. And well, while Trump did talk about it somewhat during the campaign, that was not something that people like Heritage or, say, the Federalist Society, the conservative legal group, that they had been advocating for a long time. I'll just want to mention quickly that shock and awe is a very interesting phrase to pick, because that's what the U.S. called the opening phases of the Iraq War. That's and right. As everybody saw, that did not win the Iraq War, that the opening shock and awe was able to overthrow the government, but the war went on for years. And one of the mistakes that the U.S. military made strategically was thinking that shock and awe would largely win the war by itself, that the Iraqis would see it and quit. And so what we're likely seeing now is this flurry of activity. We haven't really seen the reaction yet. Things like court cases take some time to file, protests take some time to organize. The Democratic Party was scrambling in response to its electoral loss and is starting to organize on how it wants to oppose some of this stuff. People like Illinois' Governor Pritzker have been speaking out against it in some ways, or at least picking out, say, policies that he objects to and speaking out against them, such as cutting off funds for various things that are legally required. And so we're getting all of this at once, but we haven't really seen that response yet. But on the original, yeah. How do I focus on it? I'm trying to do as much of it at once and not pay attention to the ones that seem more minor or get caught up in, say, reality show drama, like outrage over what somebody said, as opposed to what the government did.
Yeah, say versus did. All right, we're going to take a break on the show. We will come back and continue this conversation. We want to hear from you at 800-222-9455. Ken in Farina sent us a text this morning. Trump is like a surgeon operating on a patient with a chainsaw rather than a scalpel, gleefully cutting away with no idea of the damage being done, but quite sure he and his wealthy supporters will benefit from the experience, whether the patient does or not, and does he care is the question I think he's asking there. So, all right, 800-222-9455 if you want to join us. More to come here on The 21st Show. Stay with us. It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are taking stock of 2 weeks of the Trump administration and everything that has happened in that time. 800-222-9455 if you want to join us. We've already heard from people in our texting group this morning. David in Mount Morris said, well, the unnecessary trade war seems like a good idea, but I really like the fact that an unelected and non-official Elon Musk is just walking right into government agencies and defunding them without any oversight. All of us here in the Midwest know that the best way to guard the chicken coop is to have the fox guarding it. Yep, makes sense to me. I detect a little sarcasm there, David, but thank you for the message. Again, if you want to join us, 800-222-9455. With us for the hour are two of the faculty from the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Nick Grossman is in political science. He's also the author of the book Drones and Terror, Asymmetric Warfare and the Threat to Global Security. Also with us, Malaika McKee, an assistant professor in education policy, organization, and leadership. Also once worked for AmeriCorps with the National Civilian Community Corps as a regional director there. If you want to join us, 800-222-9455. All right, Malaika, let's talk about last week's news. It was really dominated by this this move to pause government funding for hundreds or thousands of programs ranging from Meals on Wheels to veteran assistance. People were just scratching their heads trying to figure it all out. What was the environment like at the university when you found out about this funding freeze?
Well, I think what was most in relief for us as faculty is that our students were coming to us very afraid Everything from should we follow certain research questions that are part of our PhD theses, questions about sense of belonging for students, questions that are historical in nature of thinking about who is a part of higher education in the United States and expanding those boundaries of knowledge that includes folks from historically marginalized backgrounds. The students were also afraid because when you talk about taking graduate student funding, many of our graduate students live on the margins. They depend on these funds in order to survive. And so one of the things that we did was in the context of my classes and my research grant or project is to say, how do we think about this from an intellectual perspective that helps us kind of situate what this means in terms of the arc of understanding democracy? That the question of DEI right now in our country is being weaponized as a racial question. But actually, when we think about the concept of DEI, it's been with us since the founding of the country, particularly when we think about who has been given a right to vote. And I really tried to walk them through that history to come to an understanding of how these are negotiated ideas that evolve according to the times and the ideologies and religious movements that all impact how we define all, who gets to be at the table of democracy and why. And so we're at that moment now, currently, where DEI has become weaponized as a racial question. And I kind of want to put it in relief for your audience to say, when you think about who is the greatest recipient of DEI and DEIA policies as it pertains to affirmative action or to policies for the federal government, the greatest recipients of DEI public policy are white women. And so we can even do a really fun experiment by asking your viewers to simply, our listeners, to go on ChatGPT and put in the question, by empirical measure, which group has benefited the most from DEI policies, white women or ethnic minorities? And when you get that answer on ChatGPT, it will tell you that by all empirical measures, empirical meaning the data that we collect, things that we can count, that white women have been the greatest recipients of affirmative action and DEIA policy. So when we think about how it's been weaponized politically, where DEIA has been seen as a black and brown issue or an other issue, an immigrant issue, the edits actually don't match the evidence. When I say edits, I mean the historical arguments that have been taken out to understand how DEI has worked don't match the actual corpus of evidence, which is DEI actually disproportionately has benefited white women. And when you look at it from a historical perspective, the concept of DEI in many ways begins with understanding the nature of voting, and in a particular in this country, the voting behaviors of white men.
Let's listen to a soundbite on this point, this DEI point. This is President Trump at a news conference last week talking about the midair crash between an American Eagle jet and an Army Black Hawk that led to the deaths of 67 people. He invokes somebody who is no longer in government service, former Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg.
The FAA, which is overseen by Secretary Pete Buttigieg, a real winner. That guy's a real winner. Do you know how badly everything's run since he's run this Department of Transportation? He's a disaster. He was a disaster as a mayor. He ran his city into the ground, and he's a disaster now. He's just got a good line of the Department of Transportation, his government agency charged with regulating civil aviation. Well, he runs it. 45,000 people, and he's run it right into the ground with his diversity.
So, I guess, Nick Grossman, let me bring you back into the conversation, because, like, you know, we can hear about all this data that Malaika brought forward and the actual facts of things, and then Trump gets up there and says what he's going to say. And there is, like, there does seem to be some sort of vibe shift happening, to use that overused word, on DEI in this country. How are you thinking about all that we've seen in that area in the past week?
So there seems to be a combination of two things. One is a cultural shift that is had a long running, you know, at this point, years of disagreements with or criticism of some specific DEI policies, either the some of the language that they would recommend using, for example, or the, you know, specific terminology, or having people in some sort of training forum, you know, like a sensitivity training forum. And there have been some people who support that, and there have been some people who have been critical of that in the corporate world, in the academic world, that this was partially tied up with something that people don't really talk about anymore, but cancel culture. And when there was a lot of the national focus on cancel culture. And so when we've seen things like some businesses or universities or others announcing that they're going to do less DEI or they're closing the DEI office, part of that is probably fear of reprisal from the government. And part of it is probably that there were some people who had objections to it in one way or another, or like the money spent on DEI administrators, for example, that there have been criticisms of these. And of course, there are also people supporting them. But with some of it, really sounds to me like straight up bigotry. So with the, you know, statements about like a plane crash, this is where I think it's correct that a lot of this has been about race, but also quite a bit is about gender and sexuality. And so you have someone like Pete Buttigieg, who is you know, a white man, who's Christian, but who's also gay and who is openly gay, married to a man, and has been attacked by a number of people who just assume that there must be something wrong with it. And there must be something wrong with his actions, and the cause of that must be because of who he is. And this has been something that has been burbling on the right, especially, say, the online right. You can see tons of this on X, on Elon Musk's site, that anytime there is something that goes wrong in a public manner, like a plane crash, for example, like other plane accidents, where they will immediately rush to say, this must have been a black person or a gay right. person or a trans person or some sort of ethnic minority. And with the implication being that straight white men are superior to them, more skilled to them, and the only reason why they had that job is because they were forced into there because of their race or gender. And of course, the historical record of that is, if anything, the opposite, that a lot of times where minorities have had to have extraordinary skills or above average of the typical employee to be able to break into something like that. But anyway, that tends to be the argument. So when there is a plane crash, and I'll note that this also came a few days after, at Elon Musk's behest, the Trump administration pushed out the director of the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration. And I don't want to get into any of the speculation territory where did that specifically cause this plane crash? Probably not. But the rush to say that instead of, oh, this is a tragic thing, and we are looking into the both incident, we're going to get to the bottom of exactly why this happened, and as soon as we know, we'll tell you, and our thoughts are with the families and all the, you know, poor people who this happened to, you know, by total accident. And instead, to the way that the government reacted, the way the Trump administration reacted, was to try to deflect blame from anything that somebody might have accused them of, whether accurate or not, and to try to play politics with it and blame others. And usually with new administrations, the idea, I mean, just obviously Pete Buttigieg is not the Secretary of Transportation anymore. The Secretary of Transportation's name now is Duffy and was nominated by Trump. And the new administrations usually have something like, I don't know, maybe 3 to 6 months, at absolute most a year, when people buy the things are going wrong now because of the last people in charge. After a certain amount of time, that they start blaming the current leadership. How come you haven't fixed it yet? We saw this happen with Biden and COVID, that the public seemed to largely give him a pass and encourage him. And then later in 2021, especially, I think this was the Delta wave of COVID, that the blame started shifting with, like, okay, you can't just blame your predecessor. You're in charge now. What are you doing about it? But the rush to quickly just assume and to kind of play the culture war card of assuming that the reason why there was this tragic plane crash must have been because there was some sort of minority involved, which is something that they did not have evidence for at all. And I'm pretty sure, I haven't checked it, but I'm pretty sure that all of the pilots were white that were involved in this. And I think all men, or maybe there was one woman on the helicopter crew. I would have to double check on that. But either way, that shouldn't be the
issue.
She was
not one of the pilots, to be clear.
Their, say, race or gender. And rushing to it is part of the prosecution of culture war as opposed to a attempt to address maybe some of the criticisms that universities or businesses had, where some people thought that DEI had gone too far or was in some way excessive.
And if I could add to that, Nick,
sure.
I think what is a really good kind of thought experiment to do is to ask, there was a SpaceX explosion that occurred on Thursday, January 16th. And no one said in the public eye, that was a DEI issue, that rocket exploded from Elon's company. So instead, the first thing that was brought up was, oh, this is a DEI issue. Then the second issue that was brought up was, oh, the person who was flying happened to be a member of the trans community. It was just so typical to go down the line of who to accuse, to deflect and to weaponize and to balkanize Americans around stereotypical prejudicial assumptions about competency and meritocracy. And I think that we need to start moving from dog whistles to dog yowls. We are now at the point politically where we don't have to intimate or hesitate about what is happening. The thing that's happening in front of us is happening in front of us. When citizens from Germany tell us, guess what? The AfD is a political party in Germany that very much has neo-Nazi leanings. Neo-Nazis are celebrating that Elon is in power and has given a speech to the AfD conference and then does that salute. And they are all on social media talking about how happy they are to see that signifier. When we sit back and go, well, what did that really happen? Is that just, do we need more evidence for that? That's taking a dog whistle and not making it into a dog yowl, a dog bark, a dog, howling. These things are happening for a very explicit reason, and that is to balkanize us as Americans, to get us to fight about who's really in charge and making charges on the U.S. Treasury. We are not paying attention to who the billionaires are in the room that are actually getting ready to enact and inflict all of these changes. We want to put them on Elon, but we are actually more in the hands of America First Policy Institute. These are people who most of us are not talking about who are a part of this. Larry Ellison from Oracle is in Donald Trump's sphere about making these policy decisions. We have the Winklevoss brothers who are part of making these policy decisions. We have the folks from Sequoia Capital, from Palantir, from PayPal. These are all the billionaires in the room who are supporting as figurehead Donald Trump to make these decisions for our society. And I think when we get sidelined by the balkanization and the fighting, we can't actually look at the source of the information that are and people and social capital that is actually making these policy recommendations for the nation and for and promulgating these very divisive balkanizing arguments.
You know, we need to take a break in 2 minutes. I have struggled with this in part because, and look, I'll say, right, I'm a white guy, I'm middle-aged, I've led a very fortunate life, so take this for what you will. But on the one hand, an administration gets to decide if it doesn't want to have like a DEI, training session in its cabinet agencies. I think that's fair game. On the other hand, it's right out of an authoritarian playbook to sort of target minority groups, single them out. We've seen that not just with Black or Latino people, but trans people in particular. This has come up. I mean, that some people are not able to get government documents now. The State Department travel advisories used to say, noticed for LGBTQ travelers, and now it just says LGB. I mean, you hear that phrase, trans erasure. I sometimes think it's hyperbole, but this is a literal example of that. And so maybe we need to take a break. Like I said, we can come back and talk about this and, what things are like within the purview of something that it's legitimate for a government agency to do. And what are the things where it's really verging into, unconstitutional, illegal, or maybe even something darker and taking us down a darker path. and how we keep our heads about us. All right, 800-222-9455 if you want to join us today. 800-222-9455. There's so much more to talk about. Sure, another text message we've gotten from some of our listeners. Sarah in Bloomington says, a couple of positives. Retiring the penny and updating the outlets for correspondence in the White House briefing room. I'm critical of President Trump, and I disagree with his other policy objectives, but I want to stay positive and recognize when positive changes are made, no matter how small. But then she goes on to say, what most concerns me about Trump's agenda is the fact that members of his own party have nothing but praise for him. I'm worried my friends and neighbors who voted for him will not recognize any of the harm until it affects them personally, directly. Also said, I'm concerned for my transgender acquaintances, my gay friends, my genderqueer friends. I have the good fortune to be a cis straight female. I may end up hiding my friends inside my attic from the government, the way Meep hid Anne Frank and others. Thanks for that note. More to come after a break. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking about the first 2 weeks of the Trump administration, which has been a flood of news and events. 800-222-9455 if you want to join us. Just this morning, we've seen news on the tariff front, which Trump was talked about this weekend. They were set to go into effect soon, but this morning from the New York Times website, President Claudia Sheinbaum of Mexico struck a deal with the Trump administration to delay tariffs, which were set to take effect Tuesday, for a month. Apparently, the two countries have reached a series of agreements on border security. Mexico is going to deploy an additional 10,000 troops aimed at stopping the flow of migrants and illegal drugs. We've also seen on the Canadian side, the premier of Ontario, one of the most populous provinces in Canada, Doug Ford is tearing up a contract, a $100 million contract with Starlink, which is a satellite internet service run by or owned by Elon Musk. So fast moving, lots still happening. 800-222-9455 if you want to join us. My guests are Malaika McKee and Nick Grossman, both on the faculty at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Nick, what do you think of, you mentioned, we talked a little earlier about the slow to ramp up resistance. 8 years ago, there were protests in D.C., people wearing those pink hats on Inauguration Day. It seems like it's been a lot more subdued this time around. What do you make of what we've seen so far?
I think that's fair to say that more subdued this time around. And a decent amount of that, I think, derives from the differences between the 2016 and the 2024 elections. So that in the 2016 election, Trump won the Electoral College despite losing the popular vote. So there was more of an essence, more of a sense among a lot of his critics that he didn't really represent the people in the same way. Whereas in 2024, he won the popular vote. So you don't have that as an argument. In 2016, he was new and it was different. And of course, now he was the president and then was very much in the public eye for the 4 years in between his presidencies. So that's a big part of it. And we also had a lot of the things that have the official political science term is democratic backsliding, of when a democracy is shifting towards something that's more authoritarian. And we had a number of those happen over the course of those 8 years also, where in the first Trump presidency, where there were multiple times where he had floated the idea of shooting protesters and had argued in during the campaign that things there should be perhaps more violence against protesters, that the U.S. military should be deployed on U.S. soil, which would violate the law, but to go and shoot protesters, which would also violate the law and violate the Constitution. But so there's probably some element of fear. I think there's probably also an element of uncertainty. So with the original big protest, the Women's March, where was maybe a broad reaction where they focused on women's issues, but, or at least that was the official line and was organized by women at the center of it. But also it was a general statement of opposition. And part of what we've been talking about earlier with the shock and awe of doing a flurry of a lot of changes now, and with doing it with both a better prepared better prepared plans, but also a stronger electoral victory, that both of that seems to have the critics and the opposition somewhat demoralized, somewhat uncertain about how exactly they're going to react, perhaps overwhelmed by a lot of the changes and uncertain about what they're going to react to. So, for example, that we saw some protests, and not big giant women's march protests or giant like George Floyd protests, but definitely sizable protests in Los Angeles over this weekend that was against some of the crackdown on immigrants and especially on arresting people who are not illegal immigrants, which had happened in a few of the ICE raids before that. And so we're starting to see some of those rumbling, but already the news had partially moved on to, by the time that protest got organized, and I'm sure there'll be more opportunities to protest the administration's immigration policies and coming forward, but by the time that it happened, we had news about a lot of the tariffs with other countries, and we had news about the Elon Musk and some of his, basically, I don't know the best term for this, personal operatives that did not have, you know, any sort of official clearance or government position, going into the Treasury and the Office of Personnel Management, and all of these things were breaking, where the protesters, there isn't something organized around that, though we might see something this week. I saw advertisements of trying to organize a protest, generate a protest at the U.S. Treasury this week. So we're starting to see more of those. I don't know if it'll entirely coalesce, but we'll have to see. It also depends on what the Trump administration reaction is to it. If they do, in fact, order the use of force against protesters, which we saw some preview of in, for example, during George Floyd protests, Black Lives Matter protests in D.C., where the Trump administration had had security services forcefully clear this area called Lafayette Square so that he could do a photo op. And we'll see maybe some of those reactions, but whether they crack down hard, that could either scare people into not protesting, or it could galvanize more people into protesting, as we've seen happen in some other countries. And possibly one other factor is there doesn't seem to be a clear leader of the opposition in any particular way, that nobody even really vying for it. Or at least in a very public manner, that's starting to coalesce the opposition around. And so all of those, I think, contribute to the either lack of an organization or lack of certainty of what exactly to do from that group. But they're still there, and I expect them to react more and more as things that they find outrageous pile up.
Yeah. All right. Let's go to the phones. 800-222-9455. Lucille is calling from Bloomington on line one. Lucille, thank you for calling in.
Yes, thank you. So I have to say I agree with your speakers. I appreciate the show. My words in relation to your first question is that Trump and company's actions are bullying and oligarchy on steroids, and it's absolutely the case that it's been decades in the making. My main point is just to say that one of their political actions that deserves but is not getting the broader attention by you, understandably, but also beyond the show, is their January 23rd executive order on fintech and digital assets. That is a more systemic agenda that undergirds all the rest. And if it gains traction, it will further privatize our already private commercial bank money system in ways that will undergird and give leeway for the rest of their agenda. So I'm not saying you need to focus on it today unless your speakers have read it and have comments, but it deserves listeners, your speakers, 21st Show's attention, and there are resources out there that have been working on this for decades, if not centuries.
Thank you so much for the call, Lucille. I appreciate it. And also, I can just add briefly onto that point that the head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau was also among the many people that Trump has fired, which is an agency that attempts to, you know, look at things like credit card fees on behalf of Americans. Let's take another call. Gordon is calling from Northern Illinois on line two. Gordon, thank you for calling in.
Thank you. One of the things I find interesting in this discussion is the way it's nuanced. When Hitler came to power, and he was elected democratically in the Weimar Republic, he began to incrementally, first of all, change the structure and cultural institutions of the Weimar Republic. And probably his first and most decisive acts was to eliminate an independent judiciary. And what the 47th president is doing at this point is very systematically eliminating some of the guardrails that we have to the idea of what a republic is. And the thing I find so ironic is that in the last election on November 4th, 77 million Americans believed or agreed that this current president would be the person that would solve their issues. And this just gives the whole idea of about the validity of democracy in the face of incremental and massive change a different aspect. You know, I would call what the 47th president is doing simply fascism. I would not beat around the bush, because what he's doing is he's using technology and nuance to fundamentally change every institution and cultural artifact of our culture. And that's what I'd like to say.
All right. Thank you for that call. Malaika, I'll let you, if you want to respond to any of that,
yes,
or
particularly
in your own
caller,
direction. Go ahead.
I just want to, I'm over here clapping. If people could see me, I'm in the studio going, yes, that's right. This is the gentleman who just explained that the guardrails are disappearing. And specifically when thinking about what Hitler attempted to do during the Third Reich, was one of the first populations of people who he went after were our transgender brothers and sisters. He went into Berlin. They burned all of the clinics. They burned all of the research, and they made them the most vulnerable group, and persecuted them. And I just think it is such an interesting axiomatic moment for us that we often say that history repeats itself. I don't think it necessarily repeats itself in that it rhymes. There are patterns here that are rhyming, that are making us question about what is the playbook here about moving towards a fascist set of governance structures. I think today's news that really exemplified taking the guardrails off of governance was the recent bill that came out of Tennessee, SB 6002, that basically says that legislators who vote in favor of sanctuary policies protecting undocumented immigrants can be classified as Class E felons, receive 6 years in prison, and a $3,000 fine. Now, that to me feels like fascism. I have never thought a legislator who has been duly elected by the people of their district, if their district said that they would like to have a sanctuary for people who are undocumented and to simply vote that concern from their constituents, I thought that's what democracy did. But in this case, what Tennessee is saying is that this is not democracy, that this is indeed a criminal offense. That, again, is we're at not the dog whistle, we're at dog barking here. And so these guardrails are so important. And what do we do about this, right? All of us are feeling deep anxiety. I don't think I'm alone in doom scrolling. I think a lot of folks are kind of stuck in a social media moment. Nick, what you talked about earlier is that the flurry of evidence is just coming to us at such a rapid pace that many of us are feeling kind of out of sorts. So these kinds of conversations that you are hosting on public radio are so important for us to begin those important discursive techniques of how do we do the work of democracy and citizenship. First, we open our mouths. We talk to one another. We read the things that each other are saying, i.e. newspapers, credible sources of evidence where it has been vetted by people who know how to search for empirical facts and truth to talk about what is really happening out there. And then we act. Nick talked about a demonstration that's happening on Tuesday at the Treasury Department. It is indeed happening. It's at 5 o'clock in Washington, D.C. They are asking anybody and everybody to please come to the Treasury and give your protest against the fact that a group of young people between 18 to 24 who are employed by Elon Musk have brought in their servers and computing equipment, and no one knows what they're doing in there. I don't care where you are on the political spectrum, whether you are Republican or Democrat, the fact that there are young people in there with computer servers who are in our Treasury, who are acting in some way that is unknown, we need to know what's going on. And that's just one example. I know that Indivisible had a meeting last night that attracted several hundred thousand people on that call to talk about how do we respond to some of these things. But we have got to start doing the active work of citizenship in order to make sure that this very fragile experiment that we call democracy is able to continue to evolve and embrace the fundamental ideas of human rights and life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness. It is a fragile social experiment. And I think that those examples from the Third Reich give us those echoes and those fears about how so easily things can fall apart.
That is a stark warning, and I'm afraid we are out of time. We're going to have to leave it there. We will definitely continue this conversation in the future. Malaika McKee, Nick Grossman, thank you so much for being with us and sharing your knowledge with us today on the 21st Show.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Malaika McKee is an assistant professor in education policy, organization, and leadership at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Nicholas Grossman is a political science professor at the U of I, senior editor at ARC Digital. You can read his writing there, and also the author of the book Drones and Terror, Asymmetric Warfare and the Threat to Global Security. Thanks to everyone who called in and sent text messages today. If you want to weigh in on what we talked about today, you can still do that. One of the best ways to contact us is by email, because we can actually write back much more easily than we can with our text messaging system. So if you want to engage with us, the email address is talk@21stshow.org. talk@21stshow.org. And you can also find that on our website, 21stshow.org. The 21st Show is produced by Anna Casey, Christine Hatfield, and Jose Zepeda. Our digital producer is Kulsum Khan. Technical direction and engineering from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. And Reginald Hardwick's our news director. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.